And on the line, I've got Lindsay Amner. Good morning.
Morning, morning. How are you?
I'm good. So you're going to be in Raglan Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at the old school. I see on the schedule there. And
yep.
You've had, I was reading the bio, you've had 34 years in the Army with doing a huge variety of things. So what's your talk going to be about?
Well, because it's for the book club, I thought I would talk initially at least about the official history series that New Zealand produced after both world wars. So a series of books, they're quite valuable these days and quite collectible. And so I've got all these books, so I thought I'd bring a few along and show them. And not a lot of people know about them. They're quite an interesting series of books, the official line on what happened in World War One and World War Two.
Okay, so how soon after World War One and World War Two were they written?
Within the next, the World War II ones were still being written almost into the 70s. A couple of them were still written, but a lot of them were produced, you know, in the year or two after the war. But they were still going. They set up this whole department to write these books, and it went for quite a while. It's quite an interesting series of books. Most countries produce histories of their wars, and they produce a campaign history or a history of a division that's about 10,000, 20,000 men. But New Zealand wrote books right down to the level of battalions. That's about 600 soldiers.
Okay.
And so a history of, and even in World War II, some of them even went down to company levels of 100 histories. So you have a book about the work of 100 men. And the World War One ones are some interesting books, things about the cyclists, New Zealand Cyclist Corps, and the Cameleers in the Middle East. So it's some quite fascinating stuff there.
Okay, so World War One, we're talking 100 years ago. So cyclists might have been the best way to get around for those guys.
Until you hit a bit of mud, of course. they didn't have mountain bikes in those days.
Right.
No, they ended up just fighting mainly as infantry. Cyclists were supposed to be dispatch riders and taking messages. But, it proved to be a little bit... they thought they were the new horse, but didn't quite turn out that way.
Right, well, World War One was famous for its mud. Most of us are aware of that, so...
Yeah.
Wouldn't have been ideal. So you started off as a common guard and soldier, I guess, years ago.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, and left school, went straight in the army, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I did a few years in the territorials, so part-time, a bit of a lark running around the hills. And,
right.
Then joined regular force a few years later and went and got a few degrees and things and eventually ended up as an education officer. So my job was to teach history and communication skills and the sort of stuff. So I was the curator of the Army Museum for a few years and ended up as the New Zealand Army historian. But in that sort of area, there's not that many jobs within Army, so I ended up running out of jobs and got offered a job in the Australian Army, editing their Army Journal and things. So I went over there and sort of had a 10-year holiday on the Australian taxpayer.
I guess when you joined the army, you probably weren't expecting that that's what you would end up doing with a large part of your life.
No, in fact, if you talk to people who knew me back in that when they were 17, 18 in the army and asked, right, who's the guys who are likely to spend a 30-something career in the army, nobody would have picked me. I had problems with authority and...
Is that what you do when you have problems with authority? You join an army?
Well, yeah, something. Yeah, I don't know why, but I ended up in the army. I had these little niches that I did and nobody else did, and it was sort of useful, but nobody really was telling me much what to do because they didn't know what I was doing. So I did my own thing and produced things for army that were fairly useful, but. Nobody sort of really understood it. So, I had a sort of a niche career in army. I wasn't out there killing people, but yeah, I wrote a few things and produced, I created qualifications, liaised with the Open Polytech and the Institute of Management to create qualifications that soldiers could get.
Oh, okay, right. So that's how you ended up with it. You've ended up with a master's yourself in strategic studies.
Various other bits of paper that say I can do stuff that I can't really, but anyway, yeah.
That's probably not what you told the heads of the army, though, is it?
What's that?
They're pieces of paper that don't mean that much.
Right, yeah, no. No, that was always my thing. I thought, well, actually, I could have done these jobs without these bits of paper, but nobody would have given me the job. So, yeah, you do need the bits of paper in the end.
Yeah, well, what were the things that you were doing, and when did that lead into writing? Because we're talking about whangaroa writers' world here, so
did
you get into that?
Well, the stuff that I wrote in Army was things like I wrote the ethos and values booklet. So the thing that says what Army is and why Army does what it does. And what it believes, etc. So I wrote this sort of booklet, which is still being produced today as the Army's, almost founding document, not founding, but its basis for being. Yeah. And it's given to every recruit sort of to teach them, this is what Army does, this is what you have to believe if you're going to belong to Army.
I'm actually curious, Lindsay, what those values are. We've been having a few discussions with other people I've been interviewing on the morning show lately about, and values are they're such a core thing, but most of the time we're not really aware of them. So I'm kind of curious what, and people probably have a cartoon idea of what Army values are because we watch too many movies. But what actually were you putting in there?
Okay, well, the Army's values are courage, commitment, comradeship, and integrity. So you had to sort of define those and work out what they were. So, and then I used examples, historical examples of individuals who had shown each of these values over the years in Army. So for courage, used people like, I'll have to look it up here, Narimu VC and Wiliapiata VC as who got Victoria Crosses for showing great courage at war. And then commitment, I used a guy called Hane Manahi, who got a Distinguished Conduct Medal in World War II, so it's the second medal down from the Victoria Cross, and he should have probably got a Victoria Cross. He was recommended for a Victoria Cross, but his actions... there's all sorts of debate about why he didn't get it and it was downgraded. And various other characters from more recent times, guys who put out a fire in a ship that was about to burn the whole of New Zealand's collection of light armoured vehicles, crawled under the vehicles with a fire hose to get to the fire, etc. And comradeship, used guys like a bloke called Captain Masters, who fought in Malaya and carried a Gurkha for about a day through the jungle after he'd been wounded, showed great commitment to his comrades. And then integrity, that's a difficult one to define, and everybody always says honesty is, part of integrity. Well, I deliberately left honesty out. Because armies are not honest. Armies practice to deceive. You deceive the enemy. One of the examples I used there was a guy who actually told deliberate lies to the enemy. He was captured, and then they said, we're going to shoot you if you don't tell us who among the Italian partisans, the resistance, has been helping you. And he refused to tell them, and so they shot him. So to show great integrity is his belief and his commitment to those that had helped him, but he refused to compromise, and save his own life by dobbing them in. Mm. So, that's Lance Corporal Dave Russell. He got a George Cross. But he told deliberate lies. He said he didn't know these guys, and that was... So that's not honest.
Yes.
It still shows great integrity. So, and a nurse who, in World War One, the ship they were on was torpedoed, and she went into the water and realized that she wasn't going to survive, so she handed over her life jacket to someone else. Again, that's a great example of integrity. So these sort of characters were listed in this document.
And that's something you show the raw new recruits when they arrive.
Yes, everyone's given a copy of it, or these days I don't know if they get a copy or are given it online, but they actually are taught lessons based on this, how Army operates, and these are examples of that we want you to follow, sort of thing.
Yeah, interesting, because it's... Yeah, like I said before, most of our, if we haven't been in the armed services or had much to do with them, most of our knowledge about them comes from watching movies, which I presume is mostly fairly misleading.
Yep. Totally.
Yeah. Yes. Do you watch war movies, or is it like just too much?
Oh, I do, but my wife is very annoyed whenever we do. I'm going, no, that can't happen. No, don't be ridiculous. Mm. The problem with war movies is they have to compress everything.
Yeah.
Soldiers move, 20, 30, 50 metres apart, often out of sight of each other. But in the movies, everybody has to be, all lined up within a metre or two so you can see everybody in the shot. So, that's the thing that annoys me the most about how they compress.
Yeah, it's all got to be. It has to be for the story and the camera that comes first. But yeah, I get what you mean.
Yep.
Yeah. So you've been an army historian and all around the books and history of the army. What is the purpose of an army historian in these army histories that you're talking about? That, like you said at the start, went down to even from the New Zealand stuff down to the company level.
Yeah. Well, they're really two. The military's focus on them is as lessons, so you learn from what went on before and don't make the same mistakes or do better than was done previously because of what was learned. So Army has sections these days of called lessons that are taking the histories and developing the lessons to be learned from them and then sending out those lessons to units or having those lessons incorporated into doctrine and policy. So it's pretty important that an army does learn from what it does before because, you always say, those that don't know history are doomed to repeat it. Mm. And so the histories are there to so that we don't repeat the errors. Often, of course, it becomes a little bit irrelevant as weapons and technology change, but there are still, lessons to be learned. Like earlier this year, last year, I took a group of Australian officers on a tour of New Zealand's battle sites from the New Zealand Wars, and there are still lessons to be learned from what happened in those wars for the modern soldier. It's not so much about fields of fire and weapons, etc., but the lessons of leadership and how to do and what not to do, what decisions to make and what not to make are still valid today. So you can always learn from history.
So one of the things you talked about before about a soldier's job might be to lie at times, and I know during a war, and you talked about misleading the enemy. So When you're writing the history, is there a little bit where you have to start digging underneath at least the publicity at the time? Like, there's definitely misinformation around wars that's part of it. Does that make the job of the historian harder, or are there records kept within the army itself that make it easier?
There are certainly records kept, but you do actually raise an interesting point that these are official histories. They are the official line of what happened. And therefore, there are certain things that aren't told sometimes in these histories. You don't have the really bad stuff, and names are not mentioned. There's no naming and shaming generally of you know, people who didn't perform up to expectations. You have the good stuff, but tend not to have the bad stuff. So there have been other books written over the years that do include more of this bad stuff, but you're less likely to find that in the official histories.
But I guess as someone involved in education, like if you're educating future decision makers in the Army, they actually have to know about that stuff.
Yep, that is. Those are a lot of the things. The bad things are the things that you do actually want to learn from. So another education officer actually in the Army wrote a book, John McLeod wrote a book years ago about the myths of the New Zealand soldier, what everybody believed about the soldier and what actually was a load of rubbish. It was quite an interesting take on looking at soldiers. You know, everybody, the thing today is that every soldier is brave. Actually, there's a fair percentage of soldiers who huddle at the bottom of their trenches and never look up and never fire their weapon. You know, there's numerous studies have shown that a very small percentage of soldiers actually fire their weapon.
I did hear that somewhere, yeah. And it's probably not that surprising. I mean, it's not exactly a fun day at the park.
No. But it's also very difficult to kill someone. And a lot of guys just can't bring themselves to do it, no matter if that's the enemy or not. So a lot of effort goes into propagandizing and making the enemy out to be some nasty beast that has to be killed in order to force soldiers to do it. And they changed a lot of the practice. So when you fire your weapons up until World War II, you just had bullseye targets, a round thing, you know, with circles, just like a dartboard. Mm. And to fire at, that was the practice. And when they discovered that guys were not firing their weapons, they changed those targets. So all the targets you fire at today is a picture of a man, a photograph blown up on a target. Mm. And that actually had quite an effect on conditioning guys to actually fire their weapons. So
some people will be a little bit horrified at that, but I guess that is the brutal reality of what war and what armies are about.
Exactly. And the problem with that is, or not the problem with that, but with an army, so you do that in this simulation these days that, you know, you can use all sorts of computer-generated things and targets come of guys, other soldiers, and you shoot them. There is some discipline instilled in army while you do that you don't fire at certain targets and you don't fire until you're told to, etc. But the problem is that we have kids today who are completely conditioned to shoot because they're playing all these computer games that have the same simulations as military targets. And so this is one of the problems of, you know, you see in America in particular, of kids killing other kids in playgrounds or whatever, that or even if a guy goes into a gas station to hold it up with a pistol, he doesn't go in intending to kill the guy. But the guy pops up from behind the counter and, oop, target up, bang.
Oh, okay.
And the guy, why did you kill him? And he doesn't know. But it's just because he's conditioned that the target came up and that was what happens in his game and he fired. The conditioning of kids with these computer games is a bit of a problem today.
It's interesting. Most people would say that would benefit the army, but you're quite clearly saying it's a problem for discipline and following orders.
Well, it's a problem for society. It's not so much a problem for army. Army will instill that discipline. If it gets that same kid, you know, you can train that to fire when they're supposed to. But in society, without that discipline being imposed, you can certainly have a problem.
Okay, so folks, we're talking to retired Major Lindsay Amner. Is that how you describe yourself, retired Major, Lindsay?
No, describe myself as a slothful retired elderly gent these days.
I've got a picture of you here. You don't look that elderly. But you're gonna be here Wednesday night at the old school, 7 o'clock, and in your capacity as a former army historian and writer, you've got some of these older, quite rare books that you're bringing. It also says here that you're going to be talking about some of the significant battles of the Gallipoli campaign, given we've got Anzac Day the next day.
Yep.
Are you going to be teaching us something that we might not know? Because we, most of us know the gist of, well, actually it's become very embedded in New Zealand culture, but there's going to be some surprises in there, some things you can tell us that we didn't know?
Oh, possibly. My thing is that we actually do the wrong day.
Okay.
New Zealand's day of commemoration should actually be the 8th of August, not the 25th of April. That's really the Australian day.
Why do you choose that day for New Zealand?
That's the day we took Tunuk Bear, and was the day that the New Zealand Brigade gave the Gallipoli campaign a chance of victory. But unfortunately there were not enough New Zealanders remaining. They handed it over and the troops that then lost it. But that was New Zealand's day. I'll go into a little bit more why Anzac Day is really Australia's day, and particularly the dawn service is really New Zealanders were not involved at dawn on the 25th of April.
Okay. Well, we at least here in Raglan, being Raglan, we hold our service at Anzac Day at 11 o'clock. So,
that's more appropriate, actually, but yes.
Okay, it's closer to the time when they went into action.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. That's actually quite common for New Zealand, isn't it? Australia dominates what we do sometimes.
Very much, and as I found being in the Australian Army, New Zealand has no impact whatsoever in Australia. But they have forgotten pretty much that there is an NZ and Anzac. Anzac means Australia.
Interesting.
Australia. And now I would get, because I do a bit of singing, and I would get asked to sing the anthems on, or the anthem on Anzac Day, and I would tell you, well, that's fine, I'll sing the Australian anthem as long as I can also sing the Australian anthem, the New Zealand anthem. And that was one guy even said, why? I said, well, you go away and think about that and get back to me.
Maybe you'd lost your accent by that point, I don't know.
Yeah. No, eventually he came back and, he apologised. Yes, of course, New Zealand was involved. But Australians basically don't know that New Zealand was involved at Gallipoli, Anzac Day. Very few Australians know that. You can go to Australian services and there won't be a single mention of New Zealand the whole time.
That's interesting because that over the period of my lifetime, I feel like that Gallipoli and Anzac Day has become far more embedded in the consciousness of the country, like it's become part of our identity as a separate nation. But if the next door neighbours don't know that, how well is that? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, it's more about the big brother, small brother thing. Australia looms large on the horizon for us, but every news we have, there's be something about Australia. But in Australia, New Zealand is just another overseas country. There's nothing on the news ever about New Zealand unless something epic happens. So they just don't see New Zealand as the same way that we view Australia, as this our closest friend and ally. Australians don't view New Zealand like that.
Probably view us more like Tasmania, I suspect.
Yeah, they're sort of it's another country that we go to on holidays, but it doesn't have any impact on Australia any way.
I guess that's the way it works. Hey, look, Lindsay, been interesting talking to you, and there's lots more I could ask you about, but it's time to move on for me here.
Cool.
But you're going to be, just remind people, you're going to be in Raglan Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, Old School Arts Centre. You're bringing some very rare books with you. And some more details about the Gallipoli campaign and why you think, was it August the 8th you said, should be our actual commemoration day.
Yep. Come along and hear all about it. Yeah.
All right. Thanks for your time this morning, Lindsay.